channel, and you can see what I look like. You can look at the setting I'm in, and it just gives me a lot more animation. I just feel a lot more excited when I'm doing this on the television venue. So I'm very, very glad to have all of you listening to me on the radio. Keep on listening on the radio. But remember, you can also watch me on TV on the Dr. Peter Breggin YouTube channel. Now, those of you who get my frequent alerts, and I hope all of you get my frequent alerts. For goodness sakes, they're free. Why not get my frequent alerts? They keep you up with a lot of what I'm doing. But we also have things that come out daily, literally the daily news and other things that come out every day on the website at breggin.com. So you can, it's just every reason in the world to go to the website daily too. But otherwise, you know, get the frequent alerts. The show is already doing well. We've only had two of them, but it's already right up there beyond our expectations, and you can keep track of that too when you go to the Breggin YouTube channel. Now, those of you who do get my frequent alerts, I had advertised having on a psychiatrist today whom I'm very fond of, whom I call the Dude. The Dude will be on next week, I hope. His connectivity did not work. He's from Canada. His name's Stephen Tickton. He's probably going to be the most interesting guest of all, but he'll be on next week with Bonnie Burstow and another of Bonnie's associates from Canada talking about psychiatry in Canada, the reform movement in Canada. So for those of you who are very much interested in the reform movement, you're going to get a big dose of it next week. And we will work on connectivity all week long until we have it. So today, I'm going to talk about stuff that's on my mind, not some of the stuff that you've been hearing about on the earlier show, for example, about putting electrodes on the foreheads of kids, stimulating them all night long in order to cure their ADHD? That's a miracle because there is no such thing as ADHD. What they're going to do is simply disrupt brainwaves all night long. That's an interesting experiment on kids. You can hear more about it on my earlier shows. And you can also go to the website, breggin.com, scroll down just a little bit to Monarch and ADHD. It's a banner, and the children's page. It's all one banner. And find out about what the FDA has in mind for our kids. And keep in mind that it won't just be kids diagnosed ADHD. It's going to be kids in general who are going to get this for any reason that any pediatrician, nurse practitioner, internist, primary care doc thinks that this might just be a good experiment because the FDA has advertised it. They've advertised it as safer than drugs. How could they be so evil? Well, I guess 4 weeks is long enough. Is that long enough, 4 weeks? Let's just think about it a minute. Kids were tested for 4 weeks. Why only 4 weeks? I can guarantee you why. I guarantee you they wanted 8 or more. 4 weeks because they just dropped out. So they couldn't get enough flies stuck on the flypaper. They escaped after 4 weeks. So keep that stuff in mind, our attack on Monarch, and join us in that if you can think of a way of doing something locally, or if you can contribute to it. Look it up on the website. You'll find out where to call and how to get involved. Other stuff I've been involved in very recently, very closely related. And that is the stuff that Elon Musk from Tesla is doing in wanting to experiment more and more with putting little caps on people's heads with electrodes to connect them permanently to computers. I mean, who would even imagine something like that since we don't even know how the brain functions on any large scale? Putting little hair-thin electrodes is not going to be safe down deep into the brain and stimulating. Eventually, I'm sure that's what they're going to want to do. But right now, they're just saying, well, we want to get information into the brain. There's no way to get information between a hard wire and a soft brain cell. There's only ways to harm and disrupt. This is all craziness. And you'll find that on my website too, and also on the frequent alert. So there's a lot of just craziness going on out there that I'm trying to keep track of. My wife Ginger and I, we're working with Melissa and Aaron Dykes, D-Y-K-E-S. And you can see me talking about mind control on their award-winning film, which is The Minds of Men. You get to it from my website. It's now got over 2 million people watching it. So there's just a huge amount of stuff swirling around mind control that is worth your paying attention to, worthy of your keeping up with. And I'm just so glad to be able to get on the air with you and talk with you about it. Now I want to switch gears completely. I want to talk with you about what life is about, what stress is about, what anxiety is about, what personal misery is about. I want to talk to you about why we find ourselves caving in, collapsing, why we end up getting angry at our loved ones. I want to talk with you about why the world gets so gray looking at times, like the lights are turning off and you don't know how to turn that switch and get those lights back on. I'm going to talk to you about my latest thoughts on what is our personal misery about. Where does it come from? Are there some common denominators? Is there, for example, something that you, yourself, can remind yourself about when you're talking with your husband or you're talking with the children, and all of a sudden the conflicts, they may have seemed minor, have put you into some sort of dark hole that you're kind of clawing on the edges of and just don't know what in the world to do about? I'm going to get to that today, sort of to the depths. And you know, even when we don't fall into the depths, a lot of times we're sort of clawing around on the edge, you know what I mean? Getting the dirt in our hands, clawing on the edge. It's just an ordinary conflict. It's just an ordinary disappointment. It's an ordinary stomach ache. It's an ordinary disappointment. But we get that sensation of, oh Lord, I'm just clawing. I'm just hanging there. I got my teeth in, whatever. Whatever your metaphor is, whatever your feeling is. I'm going to get to that today and talk with you about that in a way that I hope will be meaningful. At the start, I want to begin with the idea of helplessness, what I call psychological helplessness. That's one of the two key ideas for our personal strength here on Earth, for how we handle things here on Earth. So we have to distinguish between being genuinely helpless, that is, you're in a straitjacket in a psychiatric ward, or you've had a neck injury and you can't move your arms or your legs, or you're in a jail, and you're helpless then in regard to your physical movements, or there's a limit to your physical movements. Although, as my dear friend Bert Caron, who's gone now, a premier psychologist, psychoanalyst, demonstrated after his injury, which left him virtually paralyzed in all his limbs, that even then there is another kind of freedom. So even in the most serious kinds of physical helplessness and restraint or limitations, we're hungry, there's no food, we're searching for food, some disaster has occurred, we've lost a loved one, even when there are these physical, real life, you can touch them, limits that make us feel helpless, It has to be distinguished from the feeling of helplessness. The feeling of helplessness, that is, that I'm overwhelmed, that I'm vastly limited in what I can think or feel, that I'm stuck, that I can't get out, that I can't leave the anxiety, the guilt, the shame, the anger, the numbing, whatever it is I'm stuck with, that I can't get out of that, is psychological helplessness. Now, some of you who are familiar with modern psychology or familiar with Seligman's work, I was working on psychological helplessness a few years after he got started on what's called learned helplessness. In a way, I'm talking about learned helplessness, but Seligman and his colleagues have limited that in its depth, and they began with animals. I began with clinical work. And back in 1980, late 1970s, when these ideas of the importance of helplessness were becoming clear to me from my work. So they've done some good stuff, and they have good research with animals, and they're expanding it to people, but they're not using it as a fundamental, underlying, basic principle, as I've always used it, not just as a phenomena that might affect depression or a phenomena that relates to whether you're going to triumph in your life, but as an underlying issue of your entire life. Because I believe that we begin to fail psychologically the minute we succumb to any degree to feelings of psychological helplessness. Now, I hope that makes sense to you. I hope that that really is sticking. Think about a child. Helplessness is a physical reality in childhood. The child cannot feed itself, cannot clean itself, cannot adequately soothe itself, especially in infancy. But it's not completely helpless. Why isn't it completely helpless? Because it can scream if it's a normal child. It can wiggle. It can show agitation. It can communicate upset. And if that lasts long enough, it may fall into apathy, just as that happens with human beings when they're emotionally exhausted. But in the beginning, the child is signaling. And then, of course, when it goes into apathy, it's still, in a way, signaling if there's anybody watching. So even infants have a little capacity to not be helpless. They're mostly helpless. But they need us to respond to their cries. They're wiggling. They're looking uncomfortable. They're not falling asleep. They're looking physically ill. Things like that. But even at the beginning, and it grows from day to day, there's an element going on in an infant that is beyond helplessness. For example, infants will learn to smile and elicit a smile and smile back. So really early on, our little brains are working away, and whether it's largely biologic or whether there's a little bit of choice in it, they are beginning to develop and to leave helplessness behind. Now, a huge amount of everything that, say, is in the DSM-5, I'm going to show you, I'm up to date. It's not very up to date anymore. It's outdated, I suppose, and it never was. The DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders by the American Psychiatric Association, when it came out, I think in 2014 or 15, it represented thinking from perhaps 1520, 1580, I don't know, some really ancient Malleus Malefactorum, which was the book on identifying witches. It comes out of that basic, comes out of that basic era. So it was outdated when it was last published. But all the things that they're trying to parse out and categorize about major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, all these different ADHD, you know, whatever, wherever they're going, PT, whatever they're doing, They're really describing various states in which human beings lose control over their minds and themselves. Where we, that is, if they're describing something that remotely resembles human collapse, ADHD is not even in that category. That's just behaviors that annoy teachers, give parents a hard time at the dinner table. So, I mean, but you're talking about somebody who's suffering, trying to, you know, capture that and divide that up and give it names. Underneath all of those categories is really a person who has been overcome by the guilt, shame, and anxiety. I described that in the book by the same name, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. And either being overcome with that or lapsing into chronic anger and numbing, either one, or alternatively, which are kind of the outcomes when we really are just not there. And finally, just apathy. All of that is on a continuum of giving up. Now, I believe that in a very profound way, all psychology is autobiography. Because after all, if you develop a psychological theory and it has nothing to do with you, that would be kind of weird. So, you know, you might have some cognitive dissonance about that, you know, two conflicting ideas that can't sit in the same space at once. So I can tell you from my viewpoint, understanding myself, my autobiography of my psychology, is that every time that I have started to feel like I'm losing it in some way, I want to quit in some way or whatever, or I feel frustrated beyond belief or hopelessly betrayed, whatever the particular thing is at the moment that might be distressing me, or I'm very in touch with the misery of the world because of my reform work and also because of being a therapist and also because of being alive. You know, who isn't in touch with the misery of the world? And sometimes that feels overwhelming. We all can go there if we're those kind of folks. Every time there is a moment where I let myself get psychologically helpless, call it spiritually helpless, emotionally helpless, if that's a little clearer to you. I believe that's true for everybody. So when you are starting to lose your way, go to psychological helpless and think to yourself, am I giving up? Am I stopping thinking? Am I not making the most out of whatever freedom I have, whatever autonomy I can develop? Because if you can go there, if you can be sitting with a client, many of you are in the mental health field to watch this show, and you're starting to feel this is a hopeless cause, I better refer them to a psychiatrist for drugs, let them get evaluated. You're feeling helpless, believe it or not. You really are, or you'd never do anything like that. You'd say, oh, you and I, we can do this together. Or if you have your children and your child is just disobedient and you don't feel you have moral authority and you just don't have that strength that you once did to look at your child and say, now, I won't relate to you, Timmy, when you're being so angry and being so upset. I'm not going to reject you, but you need to calm down before we can talk about what you want. Then I'd love to talk about. If you just don't have that in you and you want to hit Timmy and or you want to storm out of the room raging or call the doctor, God forbid, think to yourself, wait, I'm giving up. I've lost my moral authority not only over my son, my daughter, but over myself. I'm giving up. So every single time, I want you to try this and see how it works for you. So every single time you aren't functioning the way you want to, think about psychological helplessness. And then what you will do, hopefully, is you regain your self-determination, your autonomy, your free will, this exquisite thing about making decisions and choices that we humans do much better than our dogs. I mean, they do it too. I really do see them looking at me, trying to decide exactly how certain I am that we are now going out when they don't want to go out because it's raining. I mean, they make decisions too. And sometimes they get the same expressions humans get, where you think they're feeling guilty, they're feeling irritable. But think about yourself, because you have so much more than a dog or a chimp, where you can say, all right, I'm caving in and I'm not going to do it. Now, that's not to say you can't be affected by your physicality and by other things. I won't tell you too much about this, but I'll tell you that when I get a cold, actually my first symptom is I start to get a little depressed. Well, I've learned to understand that signal. I've learned where that came from in my childhood. So now if I get a little depressed, I start to think, how do I feel physically? How do I feel? Or my wife, Ginger, she'll look at me and she'll say, hey, honey, you remember I had a cold? I'm just getting over, or maybe you're getting it too. And I think, no. And then I'll think, oh, maybe so. Maybe that is it again. So there are things impinging on us. So maybe we'll remember then when we start to say, well, I can handle this. I can control myself. I can figure this out. See, helplessness is it's cognitive stupidity. And I say that from personal experience. It's cognitive stupidity. So you don't think straight when you let yourself get helpless. You're going back to the infant state. And you don't have the ability to think about it, understand it. Then you might decide, well, I haven't eaten today, or, oh my God, I just had that terrible phone call, I totally forgot about it. But the whole process of being on top of your life must begin. It does begin with you letting go of psychological helplessness. The way people land in mental hospitals, the way we often go to doctors and ask for help of some kind, often comes out of giving up our autonomy, our belief in ourselves, our belief that we can figure things out. Now, I'm not talking about going to a therapist as being a form of helplessness, but if you go to a therapist, and this is relevant to those of you who are friends in treatment, family in treatment, you're in treatment, it's relevant to the psychotherapists who are listening. There's no progress unless you go in determined to be victorious, determined to regain your senses, determined not to give yourself up to the other person, not to expect some brilliant, life-changing verbal encounter or a good referral for drugs or something. Everything we do, whether we're treating patients, whether we're our patients, revolves around whether we are in charge. We're in charge. Whether we're making the decisions. I'll give you a simple psychiatric bread and butter thing. If you go to your psychiatrist and you say to the psychiatrist, I'd like to cut back on my meds, your psychiatrist, after he gets over being angry and whatever else, may say to you, all right, we'll cut your meds in half. That's a good way of getting even, but it disempowers you. So the basic principle of coming off medications, which I talk about in psychiatric drug withdrawal, it starts with you being in charge of how you come off the meds, going at a rate that you can handle, that you're in charge of. So I start people on the smallest dose withdrawal possible. Say, all right, let's figure out what's the easiest one to get down to a really small start. And then I want you to see how you feel. And then we're going to go from there about how you feel, how you're responding to this withdrawal. And some people end up going kind of fast. And I'm kind of saying, whoa, whoa. And some people start going slow. And I never say, hey, go faster. I want the person in charge as much as possible. That's how you want to run your life. You don't want to lapse into any shape or form of being a helpless human being, period. Period. And if you're helping people, you always want to bolster their sense of effectiveness, efficacy, strength. So if you're an emergency responder and somebody's pinned under a rock and you don't know what's going to happen, You reassure them anyway, because we do much better when we don't cave into helplessness. In fact, people who stay in charge of themselves, and a part of that is confidence, and a part of that is assuming you're going to accomplish something, assuming you're going to do your best, they do better in regard to whether they catch colds in experimental studies and whether they die of heart attacks. A key to life is not lapsing into helplessness, and instead having tremendous confidence in being able to make the most of your life. So that's very, very basic. A very, very basic idea. So now take a breath and shift a little. I told you there are two basic ideas, two fundamental themes to succeeding, to overcoming all the diagnostic categories. And that is to understand the function of love in your life. And I don't mean just romantic love, although it's very important for most of us, certainly for me. I mean a joyful, happy engagement with any aspect of life. I like the definition of love as joyful awareness. It's my own definition, but I can tell you it began, I'm Jewish, it began when my girlfriend Mary took me to church my junior year of high school, and I heard a minister talk about love. I'd never heard anybody talk about love in my entire life. It was not a standard in my life. And I thought, people really talk about that? That sounds really interesting. That sounds wonderful. Is that fake? Is that real? What is that? So Mary, I owe you a lot, going way, way back. Maybe I'll get in touch with you. Suggest you watch this. Love is the connectivity, the joyful connectivity, engagement, involvement with any aspect of life. A lot of you who've watched the radio show, before I had it on TV like now. By the way, thank you PRN-FM for doing this for me. Thank you for giving me this weekly radio show for many years and then allowing me to turn it in with your technology into a TV show too, that, you know, is seen a day or two or three after the weekly Wednesday. I really want to thank you again. Take a moment, thank you for that again. So love is engagement in anything. I love this show. I love talking to you right now. I love this opportunity. I love the picture behind me. You wonder what that is. I'm going to change it periodically, and much possible there'll be photographs by Gingy. That's an old digital photograph. She took it out the window of a car, looking at, in the background, a rainstorm and the outline of a tree, and every single bubble has the tree, the naked dark bark tree, in perfect view. It's a perfect picture upside down, a reflection of the tree. So I have it back up there, and I think it's a good one to have behind me. I like it. I love the duck, that duck that's sitting there. I love the ducks that occasionally grace the pond, a little pond that I have outside, and with a little creek that comes into it, with a little waterfall next to it. These things bring me joy. I hope you're just not saying, well, look at that silly guy's grinning over his wooden duck. But this is what life is about. Now, I do things that I actually hate sometimes, because then there's a higher value involved than just joy. But there's a love of life that says, stand up in court for people. Do things that are uncomfortable. I'm not urging anybody else to do that. But there's that too. And if you're going to love anybody, you have to do that. I've never said that before. If you're going to love anybody, if you're going to love your husband, your wife, your friend, your children, your co-workers, some of the people at church, some of the guys you go out with occasionally, then you're going to have to take lumps. You're going to have to be willing at times to have an higher idea, which says, you know, this is my friend. He's going through a tough time. It would be much easier to not see him, but I love him. I'm not talking about some friend that makes you feel guilty, so you'll feel bad if you don't go see him. I'm talking about somebody you love. It's a real difference. Because, see, there's a joy element in love. There's no joy in guilt, shame, or anxiety. No joy in anger and numbing. It's a joy in love. So if you love your friend, and you say to yourself, all right, I'm going to go to a hospital. I'm scared of hospitals. Oh, my God, they give me the creeps, but I love my friend. So it doesn't matter what area you're in. Let's say one of your family members gets a terrible disease. You're going to have to rise to higher values at times. Just the joyful aspect of love isn't going to be enough. The joyful aspect is a signal that this is really love and not guilt, shame, or anxiety. But you're still going to have to rise to the occasion. Now, I'm going to take this to a deep place. This idea about love and helplessness, and make a connection that I've never heard anybody else make, that I'm working on now. I'm writing a paper about it. I'm writing a book chapter about it. I'm going to have a blog, I think, coming out about him. So are you ready for this? Paying attention? The biggest, worst form of helplessness is helplessness about love. Psychosis, the extreme that things that we fall into, where we go withdraw into a nightmare. Psychosis is either a withdrawal or a collapse, depending on how you view it, into a nightmare while you're awake, or into profound, horrible depression where you don't want to get up out of bed, or where you want to kill yourself. God forbid you do. Or you want to hurt somebody else. Any of the ends of despair, I believe, are rooted in helplessness about love. Helplessness about ever having a joyful connection to anyone or anything ever again. This is deep. And it's helpful. This is not some existential psychobabble. You can actually remind yourself as you go into some deep hole that you're not only going into helplessness, psychological helplessness or spiritual, emotional helplessness, whatever you want to call it, that you're not just lapsing into helplessness. You are lapsing into helplessness about love. Ever having something you value, care about, take joy in, carries you away into a better place. And all it takes to get you out, I believe, is to remind yourself that you can love, that you're not helpless about love, that you're not. Now, here's a place where God can come in. No, I'm not saying you've got to believe in God to overcome your major issues in life. I have no ability to say that. Wouldn't want to. But I know, research shows, if you have a belief in a loving God, you're a step up compared to most folks. So then when people who always will fail in some way, I know that because I've done it more times than I would ever dare repeat. I've failed people I love. My early life, it was really, you know, I can remember lots of times when I related to people without loving them because I was desperately lonely. Ever done that? That's a failure of love. Not good for you or the other person. So there's all kinds of failures of love on every level. When your child no longer glows when you look at her or him, that's a failure of love. Because I think when we love each other, we kind of see a glow. We glow. Love, and I think that relates to God. And I'm not going to, don't quit on me. I'm not going to talk for the rest of this showtime about God. I mean, think about it. But I'm not going to talk about it. And by God, I don't mean some little old man sitting on a cloud. I mean something I have no idea about. that's ineffable, indescribable, beyond my understanding, but I feel the presence of, a loving presence in my life, beyond just the person I'm with. That is very helpful. So even though you may feel ashamed that, or it may sound outrageous, or you've had an inkling, but it's against all science, and besides, every teacher you ever had in college poo-pooed it, let yourself think about maybe there's a loving God, and maybe that'll be helpful to you when you're down and out. Now I'm going to move on from that and go a little deeper into this idea of love. I'm going to go to a place that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and it's not a gloomy place, but it's an interesting place about what is the worst aspect of giving up on love. And I think if you think about you at your worst time, if you think about your kids, your loved ones, any knowledge that you have of human beings, this may make sense to you. The worst helplessness about love. Remember, I'm connecting these two ideas. There's psychological helplessness, and then the worst is we get helpless about love. Then we become crazy. We withdraw from humans, as well as from nature, God, or anything else that might bring us joy. What's the worst? I think the worst feeling about love is that we are inherently undeserving of love. I think if you were to go into an emergency situation, maybe it's a young boy, he's 17, he's curled up in bed, he won't get out of bed, he won't eat. He's seeing terrible things, hearing terrible things being said to him by what he's seeing, having no idea that things like that actually happened to him to some extent when he was 3 or 4, that they're echoes, they're post-traumatic echoes from childhood. And you were able to talk with him in a sensitive, caring way, you would find out that he doesn't think in his deepest thoughts that he's worthy of love. He blames himself for everything that's happened around him. And he can't say his parents are to blame, because that is, for a child, is the end of the world. Especially a small child. When they get older, kids will go through horrible blaming of their parents. But the reason they're so horribly blaming of their parents is they're covering up that they still feel unworthy of love themselves. And they're blaming their parents for it. They may not put two and two together. I'm putting more two and two together as I'm doing this long conversation with you about it. That deep inside, the rageful anybody is, I'm not worthy of love and I'll take it out on you. So see if that helps you. See if when you really get to the worst pits, you realize that you feel unworthy of being loved. Now, you may feel unlovable. That's a step before the pit. Unlovable, you know, unlovable means what? You're too old, too ugly, too fat, too mean, been rejected too many times, I'm unlovable, but that's terrible. But beneath it is, I'm inherently unlovable. That's what the people you love or you're trying to help professionally are also feeling in the rock bottom of their souls. Now, they may not ever get to the feeling, and you may not ever experience it fully, but if you know that's the beast that lurks, you might be able to head it off at the pass. You might be able to say, maybe that lurks, but I'm not going there. I'm worthy of love. I remember my mother loved me, if you're fortunate, or my father, my older sister, my younger sister. Or, my dog loved me. My dog Pitch loved me. Or, even though I've had a fight with my wife loves me. She's shown me that again and again. Or my friends love me. Or God loves me. And then you can take the next step, which is I love back. I think it's very hard to love if you feel totally unworthy of love, or the step above it, unlovable. Then it's up to you to remember that you are a source of love, that every human being, certainly anybody who's watching this, anyone with some wits about them, is a source of love. If you weren't, you'd be withered up and gone. You're a source of love. So you can help people with their profound senses of being unlovable. And also, if you can get to yourself being that source of love, you'll stop thinking about being unworthy of love. Because nothing cures feeling unworthy of love than to be lovable, than to be loving. So there's a kind of a little twist on the secret to life. Feeling love is incompatible with insanity. Feeling love, feeling in touch with God, or loving your neighbor, loving people, loving life, loving something. I used to say, when I was a very sad youngster, that if I could just drag myself to my typewriter, that's how long ago it was, I'd be okay, because I loved writing. I loved writing. I still love writing. So I was blessed. I found a place where I could, in the, some more psychological lingo, flow when I wanted to, flow into writing, be at one with it, be at peace with myself and at one with the what I'm doing. I love it. So let's just recapitulate a little bit here. Thanks for staying with me with this. I'm really giving you my heart here and what I really believe. I've been thinking a lot about this lately. So all human failure starts with psychological helplessness. Or, in other words, emotional helplessness, spiritual helplessness, where we stop being as strong in our minds as we can be. We may be injured. We still don't have to get psychologically helpless. I've dealt with injured, brain injured people, overcome the psychological helplessness. They'll look at me and they'll say, well, it's still not working. I'm still having this happen. But you know what? I found a way to get by this, and I found a way to do this and that. So even if you've been hurt by my colleagues in psychiatry, you can still overcome the psychological helplessness which somewhat naturally flows from having an injury to your brain and your mind. But you can overcome it. You can become somebody who feels even stronger than you did before, that you're in charge, that you can think, that you're autonomous, that you're independent, that you always have the ability to make something. Like prisoners who tap on walls and learn Morse code. Like Nelson Mandela, who made friends with the people who imprisoned him for decades in South Africa, and who then was set free, you know, because the world was demanding it on the condition that he wouldn't do anything political, and said, I won't leave on that condition. And to keep his integrity, he didn't lie and then go out and be political. He said, I won't go. And they finally were forced to let him go. It could have ended worse for him than that, of course. He knew that. But he said, I'm in charge of every piece I can be charge of in this honest and honorable way. I think that's such a big part of being independent, is to be honorable and honest, to be proud of how you function, how you relate to the world. So that's step number one, is overcoming psychological helplessness. And you know, some embellishing the around it and how you get out of it. It's all very complicated. Life is complicated. Every time I talk about this, think about it, gets more interesting, there's more pieces to it, but I'm trying to make it simple because that's what I need. I need it simple when I'm in trouble. I need it very simple. Pete, stop being helpless. That's what I do. Knock it off. Knock it off, Pete. Get control of yourself. Don't throw a temper. Don't knock things off the table. I don't do that. But when I was young, I might have. The second thing is to remember that helplessness about love is the most dangerous place to go, to stop loving life, God, whatever you love. Now, what about loving yourself? I think that's very complicated. I'm still trying to figure that one out. I think the older I get, the more I let myself feel some joy over who I am and what I've done, but that didn't occur to me for decades. I think I remember writing, I don't even know what you're talking about with self-love. I don't think it's the key to life, not at all. It's love for others is really the key, and being loved by others, and let yourself mature into discovering one day that you actually like yourself, love yourself. But you don't get there directly. People who want to get directly to happiness, they do drugs or outrageous sex or something. It didn't work. Do good. Love. Be loved. Accept being loved and love. Help people be stronger. In all your actions toward others, encourage them to be not more helpless, but stronger. In all your actions toward people, help them be more loving just by being there and being loving, looking at them in a loving way. So the first realization is the psychological helplessness. Just knock it off. Tell yourself that. By the way, never tell anybody else that. Not unless they're going to forgive you. Never look at anybody and say, knock it off. And if you're a therapist, shame on you. Don't do it. I've probably done most of those bad things, but don't do it. Don't do it. Always approach anybody's feelings of helplessness with their, but for the grace of God, go I. Always approach someone else's helplessness with kindness and gentleness. Because believe me, if they're feeling helpless, they got reasons for it. You just got to give them reasons for not being helpless, in part by being encouraging, relating to them, asking them what they need to do, what's their worst fear right now, whatever the things are that you would do to connect and encourage somebody. Or just reminding them, I know you're going to get through this. I know you well now. And if I do feel that way with one of my patients, clients, depending on how you want to call them, the people I try to serve, you know, them, yeah. We'll get through this. Drugs? No. You and me, we're capable of this. Goodness gracious. No, we're capable of this. So that's the starting point. And then the second major point is the worst helplessness is about love, giving up on the joy of connection, the hope of connection, the beauty of connection, all those wonderful things about how we relate to one another, including seriously valued commitment to nature, commitment to love, God, to your friends. So the joy is the signal. The joy is the signal. It's not the end product, that final thing. It's the signal that, you know, when you look at a flower and you smile, you love the flower. It's a signal. You look in someone's face and you just want to smile. You know, it's a signal. It's a signal. And then you commit if you choose, if it's a good thing, if it's a safe thing, if you may get some up back, good things back from your work, from your play, from these people. You commit. And then you are responsible about the handling of your love relationships. And then on top of that, there is that great big last step. The last two steps to the bottom of the pits are the step of I'm not lovable, and then the final one, I don't deserve love. When you hit that, if you're feeling that right now, decide that's not acceptable. I'm not going to let whatever was done to me put me there. Because remember, this is so important. I'm so glad I'm getting to this before I finish. Someone put you there. Circumstances put you there. Child abuse put you there. Ridicule in high school put you there. Years of illness put you there. People in all their weakness and vulnerability, and maybe some circumstances, horrible death of a friend, a loved one out of your control, made you just feel like you don't deserve to live. Why did they die? your soldier, you went through that. But life and people put you there. There is no one on this earth to say or judge you as being unworthy of love. How's that possible? Who could tell you that? How could you even tell yourself that? How do you even know such a thing? There are murderers who have found redemption. There are people who have betrayed their best friends and been accepted back and found a way to become again deserving of love. There's just no place you can go to if you're undeserving of love. Hitler, I don't know. That's in somebody else's hands and mine. Really, I mean that. I really mean that. I don't think we do well by saying, oh yeah, that guy is really. No. We are deserving of love. Human beings, we're born to that. We're born to being nursed and nurtured and loved and coddled. We're mammals. Mammals are born to be loved and deserve to be loved. It's in our blood. It's in our genes. That makes us mammals, actually, not just people. That little pup somewhere, 4 weeks old, that's maybe being abandoned. Anybody looking at that would say, that pup deserves to be loved. Well, the pup in you deserves to be loved. Don't ever let yourself get into that place. Don't let anybody put you there. And that's, you know, when we've been battered and abused, often the thing we most remember, women, the battered women movement have talked about this, what's most remembered is the horrible things that made us feel unlovable and then unworthy of love. Remember that. And then get out of it. Get yourself out of it. And if you see somebody you love and they say, don't go there. I love you. Don't go there. And if you're a therapist and you haven't grown to love your patients over time, you're depriving yourself and them of the best part of being a therapist. Let me tell you, best part of being a therapist is this miracle of having controlled circumstances where you can rule out touching and rule out sex and rule out going out and having a good time together and all those things so that things are safe for both of you. And of course, you're going to talk to this person. You're going to start to feel affection for them. Of course you are. They're going to feel affection for you. Or it's not working. I view therapy as like a mini utopia, a protected space where we go to be caring toward each other. So let yourself enjoy doing therapy or being a lawyer, being a doctor. Let yourself feel affection for the people you work with. And again, surround it with responsibility. And if you're a therapist, surround it with ethics. And if you're a patient, surround it with ethics. You'll have the best of the relationship. So, well, this has been a surprising hour for me. I expected to be talking with someone else. It's extremely interesting, and hopefully we'll connect next week. And you'll get to see my interesting friend. But right now, I've taken the opportunity to share with you the things that are most important in my life right now, that I'm thinking about the most, that I share with the people closest to me, that I'm writing about, I'm trying to figure my way through. Because I'm not sure anybody's ever put it together this clearly in psychological terms. I think people have put this together absolutely clearly in spiritual terms, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, that God loves us and we're worthy of love. Although that, I'm sure there's terrible theological disagreement about it. That's what I take from it. God loves us, we're worthy of love. But also, whether or not you embrace God or believe in God or reject God, there's a lot of other evidence that there's no good point to feeling about yourself in any other way. You will not give anything to the world if you feel you're unworthy of love or unlovable or any of the steps around that that isolate you from people and from giving to people. You will never, never, never give as much as you can. So this show of mine today, it's an invitation to all of you out there in the world, to all of you, listen to me. Let yourself feel that you deserve love, that you deserve joy, that you're capable of obtaining love, that you can engage life with love, that the struggles you're having with other people often come down to your being afraid you're unlovable, so you're being mean or cruel, or they're afraid you don't love them, and that makes them feel unlovable. Because remember, when people are really close, if one is not being loving, the other feels unlovable and unworthy of it. So build your life around love. Build your life around love. And thank you for listening to this. I hope these ideas just lift you up and give you a new and better view of how you're living. Thank you. I'm Peter Bregan. Bye now.